From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll look at the state of the pandemic here in Milwaukee, how to get a COVID-19 booster shot, and how the city is preparing to vaccinate kids. We'll learn how the Milwaukee Consortium of Hmong Health is working to combat culturally specific COVID-19 misinformation.
We try to develop our materials in the different languages that we serve so that they can also read it in their language, making sure that they are consulting with doctors if they have any questions.
Plus, we'll learn about Milwaukee Rep's latest production, Dad's Season Tickets.
People are calling it a quintessentially Wisconsin show, and I didn't set out to write a quintessentially Wisconsin show. I just wanted to write something that kind of reflected my experience, both as a Packer fan and as a person in the theater.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. The COVID-19 pandemic is nearing its two-year anniversary. In that time, we've experienced highs and lows, moments where the end seemed near, and resurgences that made it clear it wasn't. So where are we now? Commissioner of Health Kirsten Johnson from the City of Milwaukee Health Department joins me now to talk about the state of the pandemic here in Milwaukee. Kirsten, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So there are a lot of competing narratives right now about the state of the pandemic, both in the U.S. and here in Milwaukee. But one thing remains clear. We're really not out of the woods. How would you describe the state of the pandemic in Milwaukee right now?
So that's a really good question. I think the state of the pandemic currently is we still have a high rate or a high burden of disease in the city of Milwaukee. It is beginning to decline. I think largely the increase is driven by the Delta variant over the course of the summer. We're seeing cases decline, but if we've learned anything, it's that this pandemic is not predictable. If we think about what happened last year when we went back indoors after the summer, our cases did increase, but at that point we didn't have vaccines. So right now we have about 58% of adults in the city of Milwaukee who are fully vaccinated, which really is a protective factor, again, as we head indoors into the fall.
So we're looking at about 58% of people vaccinated. That still leaves a fair amount of people who aren't vaccinated. We're also in a stage right now where we're looking at booster shots. A lot of people have been interested in those. Are they available in Milwaukee, and who is eligible to get them right now?
So right now, they are eligible in Milwaukee. As of today, the City of Milwaukee Health Department is offering boosters. So all three, the J&J, the Moderna, and Pfizer. And currently, the individuals who are eligible are really anyone who is forward-facing in their job, so interacting with the public. Individuals who are who are older in age are also eligible. But again, if you think about the adults who are in roles, who are again working with the public, they're all, anyone over the age of 18 who's in a role working with the public is eligible.
As we're looking at the unvaccinated population, we're looking at about 40% of people here. That means, of course, when we go to the grocery store, when we go anywhere public, we're in a situation where we probably have people around us who aren't vaccinated, even if we are vaccinated. With that in mind, what are the precautions that we should continue to take?
So I think, we should continue, if you are in a public space around people that you don't know, you should absolutely wear a mask. So that is really just it. We know masks work. We know they're effective when you're wearing them. They protect you and they protect the people around you. So, if you're at the grocery store or if you are, attending some sort of event where there's a lot of people and you don't know them, you certainly should wear a mask. I think as we move into the holidays, I know Dr. Fauci came out and said this last week, as did the director of the CDC, that, certainly you can enjoy the holidays with your family and friends. Again, just keeping an eye and consideration on who's vaccinated and who's not. I think one of the things we have to look forward to in the immediate sort of coming weeks is vaccine. Children between the ages of 5 and 11 will be eligible. So again, another protective factor as we head into the holidays, but also as we think about how we interact with socially and with our families.
As you just mentioned, we are looking at a landscape in which children might be able to get vaccinated sooner rather than later. Does the city of Milwaukee have a plan for how we are going to get this group vaccinated?
We do. So really, it's a collective and collaborative effort with our healthcare partners. So all the healthcare systems in the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County are anticipating providing vaccine for children. But we're also working with the school districts, private schools to set up clinics specific for children. So staffing clinics for kids to make sure that it's available at school sites throughout the city. We will also have vaccine available at all of our Milwaukee Health Department sites. And then we are also planning some fun kid-focused incentives with organizations around the city.
What are some of those incentives?
So I'm not at liberty to say yet, but they will be announced in the coming weeks.
Well, and with that in mind, although we do have a significant group that aren't vaccinated, some, of course, cannot be vaccinated. That should be noted. But others can. You have some incentives for people who haven't been vaccinated yet and for people who have only gotten one vaccine shot.
Correct. So we currently have a vaccine incentive for anyone who hasn't received their second dose. They can go to any of the City of Milwaukee Health Department sites. So our Northwest, South Side, or our new site on St. Paul, which is the old DOT admissions site. And if you haven't gotten your second dose, we encourage you to come out and get your second dose. If you're from the City of Milwaukee, you can get a $25 gift card for the second dose. And we are planning to provide additional first dose incentives, but really are working on that internally.
Sure. So it's unclear how long this pandemic is going to last. I think a lot of us have become a bit pandemic weary. It feels like we've been living in this space for quite a while now. As somebody who records out of a closet, it can wear on you. What is your best advice as we try to navigate this pretty uncertain future?
This is a good question. I think all of us were really hopeful last spring when the vaccine was finally available for everyone, and we saw our case numbers start to really decline over the spring and early summer. That this was it, that we were moving out of this, we were moving out of the pandemic into a place where we could resume life as normal. And I use sort of normal lightly. I'm not sure we'll ever return to pre-pandemic behavior. But I think COVID-19 is going to be with us for the foreseeable future. And I think people really need to take into consideration the implications for their own lives and the level of risk they're willing to take. And and again, we really are encouraging people who don't want to get vaccinated to talk to their medical providers, to talk to people they trust to get accurate information. And truly, the only way that we're going to get out of this entirely is for more people to get vaccinated. 58% of Milwaukee adults are fully vaccinated. And that leaves, like you said, that there's 42% who are not, so a little less than half. There's certainly risk involved. So people and families and individuals need to weigh their level of risk. Certainly, if you're not vaccinated, you are at increased risk of severe illness and even death, hospitalization. If you are vaccinated, it's much less likely that you'll be hospitalized or have any adverse outcome from the virus. So again, people need to weigh their risk and determine what they're willing to do and not do. And, for example, my children are not yet vaccinated. I'm looking forward to the next week or two when they can get vaccinated. They're 5 and 6. And at that point, we've canceled vacations. We've, I won't put them on a plane. We are very careful about who we interact with. And we ask the questions of our family and friends, are they vaccinated or not? Because we just simply don't want to expose our children. So again, I think people really need to weigh their level of risk and understand, you may have to mask in public spaces for a long time until those vaccination rates increase and we really see the virus go from being a pandemic to endemic.
Kirsten Johnson is the Commissioner of Health for the City of Milwaukee Health Department. staying up to date on the latest COVID-19 information can be overwhelming. From variants to booster shots, there's a lot to stay informed about. And to make matters worse, there's a lot of misinformation out there. Much of that misinformation comes from unchecked sources on social media that doesn't get flagged, especially if it isn't in English. Maihua Mua is the executive director of the Milwaukee Consortium of Hmong Health. She says a large portion of the Hmong community gets their COVID-19 information from social media. Mua spoke to Lake Effect's Mallory Chang about the work they're doing to protect Milwaukee's Hmong and Southeast Asian communities from COVID-19 misinformation.
Thank you so much, Maihua, for joining me on Lake Effect. I really appreciate you being here today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Your organization does a lot in sharing health information in Hmong to the Hmong community, and especially about COVID-19. What does getting COVID-19 information in Hmong look like?
Well, you know, we're not the only organization that is getting the information out to the Hmong community. We have several other organizations, such as Hmong American Women's Association, Hmong American Friendship Association, and I'm sure the Hmong Chamber is also doing some work there as well as many other non-Hmong agencies that work with the Hmong community. But at the Milwaukee Consortium for Hmong Health, you know, we try to get the words out via social media, especially using our Facebook platform, as well as our website. We also call our clients and inform them, making sure that they understand, making announcements through churches. We're also serving beyond the Hmong community. We provide services to the Laotians and our newer Southeast Asian refugees from Myanmar, the different ethnicity groups there as well. And so we try to get all of our information in the different languages that we serve.
If you could generally just speak to this, how do most people that you talk to receive their news or updated information?
A lot of the people that we talk to are receiving information via social media. You know, Facebook is something that many of our people are into. And so they get a lot of Facebook information as well as YouTube. And many, many of our medical professionals have tried to develop YouTube educational materials to share with our community so that people can get the accurate information about COVID-19 and the importance of practicing social distancing and staying safe.
Just speaking on social media and speaking about Facebook and YouTube, Facebook is known to rarely flag or to filter misinformation that is not in English. They don't do a really great job at that. Or even on YouTube, they don't do a really great job at that of flagging misinformation that is not in English. How does your organization and other organizations in Milwaukee combat that misinformation from spreading?
What we do is we get on our social media and our Facebook, and we insert information with references to where we get the information from. And because we are an organization that provides education on cancer, we follow CDC and American Cancer Society's protocols, as well as the local Milwaukee Health Department's protocols. And so we also try to go online to find medical doctors, especially in the Hmong medical doctors, where they, you know, they develop their own videos on YouTube and they share it via YouTube and Facebook. And then we pull their information and then we reshare those to make sure that the Hmong community are getting the accurate information from medical professionals.
What are some of the challenges with trying to combat this misinformation?
Well, at the very beginning of COVID last year, there was a local woman who, you know, who has probably has a great number of followers. I don't know her very well, but she was posting on Facebook in Hmong telling the elders that COVID is a hoax. It's a government thing. It's nothing to be afraid of. And one of her really good friend is a registered nurse, Hmong as well, was supporting her. And so one of our very popular Hmong activists in the Twin Cities saw this Facebook message, and I'm not connected to, you know, to the woman here in Milwaukee. And so I was not aware of it until the activist contacted me directly. He contacted me and said, hey, do you know this person in Milwaukee? I'm like, I don't know her personally, but I've heard of her. And so these are the informations that, you know, these are the kinds of things that we have to combat, that, you know, local community members are speaking and saying that it's a hoax, and then having other nurses and health professionals supporting her on that was a huge disservice to our community.
And as we start to receive new and updated information about COVID-19 as it starts to develop and with the third booster shot, what have been some major challenges for your organization in keeping up to date with that and being able to share that?
Well, the challenge for us is that many of our people are not as social media savvy. And so to get the words out to the community at large is very challenging. So we'd have to work with younger generations to help us share the information with their elder parents and relatives. Other things that we try to do too is, you know, to develop our materials in the different languages that we serve so that they can also read it in their language, and making sure that they are consulting with doctors if they have any questions and not just talk to, you know, people that they know in spite of, you know, what people are saying on social media or relatives are, you know, are giving different informations about how to protect yourself or how to cure yourself from if you are tested positive with COVID. And so these are the kinds of things that we are constantly combating to make sure that people are still following protocols. Consult with your doctors. You know, if you're not sure, give us a call and we can try to help find resources for what you need. So these are the kinds of things that we constantly battle with. And now the hardest thing right now that we are facing is the fact that many people are very hesitant or refuse to get vaccinated. And it's very hard for us to work with those individuals. And, you know, some of our clients, you know, we just have to tell them straight out and said, you know, if you're not vaccinated, we cannot serve you in person. We will not be able to go with your doctor's appointments. We will not be able to come over and review your important documents for you anymore, or help you apply for We Energy. I mean, yeah, we are a health education organization, but there are many things that we have to do in order to help break all the barriers before our clients will go to get themselves screened for, you know, different diseases. And so, you know, what has helped made our organization reach 100% vaccination with our clients is that because they need our assistance. And so they know that they have to get vaccinated. The ones that are not vaccinated are family members, relatives of our clients. And if they can't do that, then we tell them, you know, if your family members or your relatives are not vaccinated, you need to be very careful because you have chronic health conditions and that makes you more vulnerable to catching the virus.
You also are doing contact tracing efforts too within your organization. Tell me a little bit about that. How are you all doing that?
Well, what we are trying to do is to try to follow what the health department is doing, trying to use some of the materials to help us make sure that we cover all the grounds that we can to make sure that people are aware that someone is tested positive and the rest of the people that may have been in contact with that individual or directly or through other individuals to make sure that they are getting tested. This is not an easy thing to do because a lot of times people don't know where they may have gotten it from. So I'll give you a prime example within just my own family. My sister-in-law and her husband and her children, the family that she lived with, all got COVID, but nobody knows where it came from because, you know, one son and daughter-in-law bring their baby to her to take care of during the day while they go to work. The son and daughter-in-law that they live with also go out to work, you know, a couple of days a week. Their two older grandchildren go to school. So they don't know where it came from, where they may have gotten it. You know, they talk to some people, some colleagues, but they really don't know where it came from. And so, you know, we pretty much hit a dead end there. But then, you know, we were able to contain it within just those two households and not spread it to the other siblings or the other children of my sister-in-law's. So it's been a little challenging for us. It's hard to trace when people don't know where they may have gotten it from.
How is the organization conducting contact tracing efforts within the client base that you all work with?
Yes, we do the tracing with the clientele that we face. We also try to trace with people that we hear that may have contacted, you know, COVID by word of mouth. I mean, we are a very, even though we're large, we are still very tight-knit as a community. If we hear that someone is positive, we try to contact that individual or that family, find out, hey, what, how are you doing? You know, what happened? And then also offer them personal protection supplies as well. So, and, you know, building a relationship there to get the information that we need. A lot of times you can't just go down the questions. You just have to develop a conversation to really get the picture and understand where they're, you know, what may have happened, and not impose that you are trying to just draw out the questions, but really show them that you care about what's happened to them, that you are going to be there to help them. Also encourage them to get vaccinated if they're not vaccinated yet.
And that is so important to have that human aspect, that personal relationship aspect, because getting sick is really scary, and getting sick if you don't have all the information, and if even if you don't speak or read in English too, it's an additional barrier. So COVID-19 is going to be here for a long time. It's quite uncertain for how long or to what degree. How is the Milwaukee Consortium for Hmong Health preparing for that?
Well, we just have to make sure that we are always equipped with supplies to be, you know, handed out to families and individuals that need them. We continue to work with different partner organizations who are willing to provide the vaccinations to our population, getting the words out as much as possible, and continue to have the education online so that people can at least run across our website or our Facebook and see that what we are doing and know that we are a resource for them. That's all we can do at this point, is constantly be out there so that people are aware of us and our work. I would say, you know, especially for those that are doubting that this is a real thing, it is. Just take a look at all the beds in the ICU. And in most cases, some hospitals don't even have enough bed for any sick individuals anymore. And so if we take a look at that, then we need to understand that it is real. It is hitting everyone. And I personally have lost two cousins who are brothers 1 month or 1 month apart earlier this year, and how devastating that was for my aunt. And so although I have not experienced the symptoms of COVID, I don't ever want to experience that at all. I would love to be able to see everybody that I know face to face in person and know that everybody's healthy and alive, and that I can still call on them and that I can expect to see them again. The saddest thing would be when we are able to come back together and say, oh, it's too bad now this person is gone, or we can't see this person anymore. That's when reality is going to hit us really hard.
Thank you so much, Maihua, for joining me here on Lake Effect. That's a really important point that I think that all of us should carry within our Milwaukee community and our greater community, that this pandemic is not over and there's still a long way to go. And I really appreciate the work that you and organizations like yours are doing. So thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me on your show, and thank you for bringing light to the AAPI community.
Maihua Mua is the executive director of the Milwaukee Consortium of Hmong Health. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang about culturally specific misinformation about COVID-19. You can find links to their resources as well as the latest information about COVID-19 at WUWM.com. Coming up in about 14 minutes, we'll speak with the writer of the play Dad's Season Tickets, which makes its Milwaukee debut after a historically successful sold-out run at the Northern Sky Theater.
I've always asked the question of the cast, is there too much football in this show? And they all say no, because there's so much more than that. And especially in Wisconsin, you find that even Packers traditions are not so much about just football.
But first, a wildlife expert explains why he thinks the gray wolf should be put back on the endangered species list. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. A judge has halted Wisconsin's fall wolf season just days before hunters were set to take to the woods, siding with wildlife advocacy groups who argued that holding the hunt would be unconstitutional. The order is in response to a lawsuit filed in August, seeking to stop the hunt and invalidate a state law authorizing annual wolf hunting seasons. The gray wolf has been on and off the federally protected species list. More than 100 scientists from around the country are calling on the federal government to re-establish gray wolf protections. Adrian Trevis is one of them. He's a professor of environmental studies at UW-Madison. He spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz in May, and he begins by explaining what led to the wolf's delisting in 2020.
The Trump administration removed federal protections from the gray wolf in November 3rd, 2020, and did so against the advice of the majority, if not all, of the peer-reviewed scientists whom they contracted to look at their science. I was one of those five scientists. And four out of five of us found major shortcomings. I would say all five of us found shortcomings in the science that in some cases should preclude delisting by the federal government. But the Trump administration went ahead with it anyway on Election Day last year. Where I weigh in on this topic is about the best available science, and the current delisting was done in sort of flagrant disregard for the best available science.
Is part of this, the best available science says that the species has not fully recovered?
That's somewhat correct. So the Endangered Species Act specifies that to be delisted, five conditions have to be met, and a species has to have recovered all or a significant portion of its range at the time of listing. And at the time of listing, the gray wolf range was mapped across portions of 30 or more states. And it's only recovered a handful of those, less than 20% of its original range in area. It would be useful, I think, for your listeners to understand that the Endangered Species Act doesn't say anything about the number of wolves. And that's because the act covers so many different species that live at different densities and abundances in different habitats. So Congress, in its great wisdom back in 1973, specified a geographic criterion for delisting, and wolves are nowhere near even 50% of their listed range. Myself and other scientists believe that they haven't met the legal criterion for recovery. On top of that, there's one provision of the act requires that the states and tribes that receive authority for wolves after federal delisting, that those states and tribes have adequate regulatory mechanisms to protect the endangered species and make sure it doesn't get back on the list. And in my evaluation, and I've done this formally and publicly with evidence, I've shown that there are inadequate regulatory mechanisms. Here's an example of an inadequate regulatory mechanism we have going on in the Western Great Lakes states right now. The major cause of mortality, that means the primary cause of mortality for wolves, is undetected and unregulated killing by people, what I call poaching. And most of that goes undetected, and therefore it can't be regulated until the state agencies change their practices towards illegal killing, start measuring it accurately, and start trying to enforce against it and intervening against it. That means investigating cases of illegal killing and prosecuting. So none of those things are happening. It's not being measured accurately, and it's not being enforced effectively. So without that, we have inadequate regulatory mechanisms here in the Western Great Lakes.
Wisconsin does have a wolf management plan that it crafted a number of years ago. It's due to be updated. So in your scientific opinion, this poaching element should be an integral piece of that management plan. Is that right?
Yeah, 100%, Susan. It should be front and center because it's the major cause of mortality. We can't get a scientific handle on conserving a species until we have a handle on its major cause of mortality. So a lot of your listeners might be wondering, what is all this fuss about wolves? Why is it always in the news? And partly it has to do with the conservation of endangered species, but partly there's an issue here about how our society and how our government deals with science. Is science really the evidence base that decisions are built upon? Not that the science dictates the decisions, but that decisions are made in full awareness of societal values with a solid information base. And currently, that's not happening very efficiently and effectively, partly because our wildlife agencies can get away with making decisions by ignoring the best available science, by cherry picking the science they prefer. And that's going on in Wisconsin right now. A good example of it is the 1999 Wolf Management Plan. It's 23 years old. It's way out of date. Even the update in 2006 did not improve the quality of the science. There are international standards for scientific evidence, for the quality of scientific evidence. Some of those standards indicate that two studies are equally valuable, and other standards would indicate that clearly the evidence being used now in wolf management is not the best available science by clear independent standards. And I'm not talking about whether one likes or dislikes the results. I'm talking about the quality of the methods and the strength of inference they bring to the problems we face. And currently, those are being largely ignored by wildlife agencies around the country.
So are you talking about research that goes on outside of the DNR, outside that State Department, that is peer-reviewed, submitted to wildlife management professionals that should help to guide them as they look at, in this case, wolf management now and moving forward? Is that part of what you're getting at here?
Yeah, that's part of it. That's sort of the basement, the minimum level at which scientists accept evidence. It needs to go through independent, anonymous peer review at reputable scientific journals. Now, scientific journals vary in quality, and therefore the quality of the peer review can vary depending on journals. As far as I can tell, Wisconsin DNR does not pay attention to the quality of journals in which research is published. So that's one thing. But the second thing is the methods that are used in the study can help us discriminate good from better science. So for example, in the biomedical field, what we saw with the pandemic this past year is that until a therapy for COVID-19 passes the highest standard, what's called the gold standard of a randomized clinical trial, it can't go to market. It cannot be distributed to the general public. That's an example of standards of evidence, which also apply in wildlife management. So let's take a case with wolves and livestock. There is gold standard evidence, randomized controlled experiments on non-lethal methods for protecting livestock from wolves. We know that some of those non-lethal methods are effective because of that gold standard experimental evidence. We have no such evidence for lethal control, and the evidence we do have that's of a lower standard suggests that lethal control is risky and can be counterproductive, actually raising the risk for livestock. So listen, until wildlife agencies and our government in general take into account different qualities, different levels of quality in scientific evidence, we're going to keep being misled when we try to manage an elusive and difficult to study species like the wolf.
So is there another key area of your research, of your findings through that research, that you think should be considered as Wisconsin updates a management plan?
Yeah, so let's get back to poaching. Illegal killing, like I said, it's the major cause of mortality, and therefore any effort at conserving the species needs to address the major cause of mortality first and foremost. And illegal killing has been underestimated by the state, and I've been telling them that since 2012, if not 2014 or so. So about 9 years I've been warning them that they're underestimating and mismeasuring illegal killing. We've published that, most notably in 2020 by the work of Dr. Francisco Santiago Avila, and in the best journal that any Wisconsin wolf research has been published in. We proved without a doubt that illegal killing, and most of it is called cryptic poaching, where it's the shoot, shovel, and shut up phenomenon type of poaching. We've shown without a doubt that that's the major cause of mortality. It's being underestimated, and it increases when wolves are delisted or legal protections are removed. Now, the state could retain authority for wolves and address poaching by making them a protected non-game species like the badger. So it's not that I'm saying the federal government has to have authority for wolves. The state could do it if they wanted to, but they'd have to get a handle on poaching. And to do that, they have to understand and use the best available science, which at this point they've just been ignoring.
So how much of this, Adrian, in Wisconsin's case, is a matter of state law and how much is DNR management? In other words, we have a state law in the books that says there must be a harvest, an annual harvest. When it's federally protected, of course, no, we cannot. But anytime it is delisted, then there must be a harvest planned and carried out. Is that a key issue here in Wisconsin? Is it right there at the legislative level?
Well, it certainly could be. I mean, U.S. legislatures are the first among equals of power, the most powerful branch of our government. So the legislature could certainly have mandated best available science and given DNR guidance on how to follow that. Moreover, the legislature could have aimed for a more equitable and treatment of wolves that respects public trust duties and recognizes the diverse values across our state, that most of which are non-consumptive values towards wolves, meaning most people don't want to kill a wolf. They want to enjoy its presence in the wild. So the legislature certainly has a lot of power in this regard. Also, the legislature could designate wolves as a non-game protected species. Now, I don't expect that to happen. So we're down at the level of the agency, the executive branch agency, the DNR, as well as the courts for regulating how exactly wolf hunting is done. And so we're in this process right now here in Wisconsin with the Natural Resource Board and the Department of Natural Resources, where rules are being developed and promulgated. And there's a certain process one has to go through. So we'll wait and see if we see an improvement in policy compared to what happened in February 2021. That was something like a free-for-all, I'd say.
So, Adrian, do you see, even a prick of light at the end of this wolf management issue for Wisconsin, for at the federal level? What do you think?
So I'll take federal first. At the federal level, the new administration is making the right sounds about the importance of high quality science and protecting the environment. That's promising. They are reviewing a whole slew of Trump administration reversals, rules, and regulations that damage our environment. So I find that encouraging. In the federal courts, there are at least two separate federal lawsuits that have been filed against the delisting. They don't focus so much on Wisconsin, as far as I'm aware, but more the situation out in California, Oregon, and Washington, basically claiming that the wolves of those regions were ignored by the Fish and Wildlife Service when it delisted. And then at the state level, I still hope that Governor Evers will stand up for best available science, as it was part of a plank of his platform, an education platform. I have spoken with his staff and members of his team and members of the Attorney General's team about this issue of illegal killing and best available science. So I'm optimistic that things may turn around. We do need the public to speak up, demand from its politicians that they actually pay attention to the quality of science, not just cherry pick the results that they like. And we need the public to stand up for wildlife, which is a legacy for future generations.
Adrian Trebis is a professor of environmental studies at UW-Madison. He spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz in May. We'll take one more break and then return with the writer and lead actor of the new play, Dad's Season Tickets, opening at the Milwaukee Rep this week. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Wisconsinites know Packers season tickets are a big deal and hard to come by. And if you're lucky enough to be in a family that does have season tickets, you may understand the dynamics of the Milwaukee Rep's latest play, Dad's Season Tickets. in the new musical comedy by Milwaukee native Matt Zembrowski. A family of three girls tries to win over their father, played by John Daly, in order to inherit his Lambo tickets. Dad's season tickets had a sold-out run at Northern Sky Theater in Door County before the pandemic, and it'll reopen at the Stackner Cabaret this Friday. Zembrowski and Daly join Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share more about the show.
People are calling it a quintessentially Wisconsin show, and I didn't set out to write a quintessentially Wisconsin show. I just wanted to write something that kind of reflected my experience, both as a Packer fan and as a person in the theater. And so the show is it's a celebration of family and what it means to be a family and what it means to kind of get over some tough times and share some good times. And it's also sharing traditions. And as we all know, here in Wisconsin, the Packers, and especially if you have season tickets, is quite a tradition that transcends most other, I think, extracurricular activities.
Definitely. Now, is this show set during a certain Packers season?
It is. It was set during the 1996 run to the Super Bowl. And so it's still very fresh in a lot of people's minds. As a matter of fact, I was just at the Packer game, not this past Sunday, but the Sunday before, and they had a 25th anniversary reunion with all of the surviving members of the team. And it was really cool seeing how some of them look like they could still go out there and play. I mean, it is that recent in our memory, but it still feels like it's a little bit of Wisconsin nostalgia at this point as well.
Well, and from your virtual background that our radio audience cannot see, I know you're a Packers fan. John, I assume you at least root for the Packers or are a Packers fan?
Yeah, well, I grew up in Wisconsin and I left Wisconsin for about 20 years. So I wasn't in Wisconsin in 1996 when the run to the Super Bowl happened. But when I was a kid, I grew up with the Packers. I lived and died with them. I remember watching the championship game, the 13 below championship game when Bart Starr had the quarterback sneak over Jethro Pugh. I was right there at age 13. So I was a big Packer fan when I was a kid. So it's wonderful to be back in that and kind of flexing those muscles again. It's really great.
Right. And Matt, with all the memories and feelings associated just with being a fan or remembering certain seasons, certain games, you know, what was the thing about this team that made you want to write a musical about the subject, or just all of the dynamics that branch out just from that one core concept of being a Packer fan?
I try not to write shows that are super contemporary, because anytime you write something that's contemporary, especially a stage show, the references can change on a dime. You know, like something that's funny one day is completely passe the next day. So I figured we were pretty safe by setting the show in the 96 season. And that for me was really the start of my fandom. I did not grow up a Packer fan because my dad never forgave the Packers for leaving County Stadium when they were playing in Milwaukee. And so I discovered the Packers on my own. After I had, I'd gotten into baseball, I needed something to kind of occupy my time when baseball wasn't on. So I went and looked into the Packers, and this group of guys, they were just so entertaining to watch. I mean, between Robert Brooks and his touchdown catches and Antonio Freeman and Edgar Bennett, and of course, all of Brett Favre's antics. I mean, just watching him, it was so much fun. It was so easy as a kid to kind of get into how much fun Brett Favre was having, because he looked like a big kid himself.
For sure. John, you play Frank, who is the father kind of deciding what to do with his season tickets amongst his daughters, you know, as a big legacy, what to do. What stands out the most to you about this character?
Well, for one thing, it's really fun to kind of visit this relationship. As a guy who played King Lear, it's kind of a gas, because there's this tiny, tiny reference. You know, he's getting on in years and he's ready to pass on these season tickets, which of course is a legendary thing that you have to think about when you're in Wisconsin. But he's got three daughters. And so he's got to decide basically how he's going to break up the kingdom. So it's in that way, it's just really fun to do that. As far as being a father myself, the idea of how important it is to keep the relationships between your kids, to keep them going forward, to keep them positive, to keep them full of love, even when things get tough. And, you know, when there are conflicts between the kids, it it's kind of painful for the parents. You can't really take sides. You have to just do your best to try to get them through it and hope that they're going to come back together again. And it's not like there's this big, heavy divorce or dissolution or anything in the play, but that relationship, which dad values so much, is going through some tough times. So that is really it's a wonderful thing. It's really easy for me to relate to as the parent of two kids.
What would you both say to someone who doesn't want to go and see a, quote, sports musical? You know, how are you appealing to both Packers and theater people, which normally kind of operate in separate spheres?
Well, that was really my intention for writing this. As I said, I started out in the world of sports. I was into baseball long before I was into theater. And so it's always kind of in the back of my mind to try to bring factions together. And every step of the way, every workshop, every reading, every production of this show so far, I've always asked the question of the cast, is there too much football in this show? And they all say no, because there's so much more than that. And especially in Wisconsin, you find that even Packers traditions are not so much about just football. And invariably, there's always somebody or several somebodies in every cast who comes into it saying, I knew absolutely nothing about football. I love this show, and I now know more about football than I thought I ever would. So it was very much a conscious decision to try to find a balance, to try to bring as many people together, especially in the crazy times of division that we're in right now, to try to bring people together for something we can all enjoy and root for.
John, has your longstanding career involved any other sports plays?
Let's see. I did a production of Bleacher Bums, which is basically a play that takes place in the bleachers at Wrigley Field during a game between the Cardinals and the Cubs. So I have a lot of experience in learning, and it's a real trick, a real challenge to capture the idea that you're watching a game as the action is happening. You got to be really specific about where am I looking? You know, this play starts at the 20-yard line. And it's only going to get about as far as the 40-yard line, and then they're going to punt, and the Packers are going to pick it up at about the 34. You know, everybody has to kind of be looking in the same direction in order to really capture that. So that's a challenge that this play also has. Other plays, I think. I did Damn Yankees years ago. I played the devil in Damn Yankees, which was okay, but I really wanted to be one of the coaches or something, because I wanted to wear a uniform. I've never gotten to wear a uniform on stage, but
well, I imagine the wardrobe is nice and comforting in this, and I assume you're wearing like a Packers sweater or shirts or changing in and out of that for the whole thing, right?
Yeah, we have a lot of costume changes, and they all involve Packer memorabilia, so it's great.
So Matt, this is your rep debut, and this show is coming off of Northern Sky's, you know, best-selling musical run ever. And Northern Sky, for people who are unfamiliar, is in Upendoor County, outdoor park. You know, it's usually the shows there are very Wisconsin, you know, central and draw camping crowd, tourists, things like that. But what are you most excited about for Milwaukee audiences to experience? Because I feel like the Northern Sky is one unique experience. What are you excited about for incorporating this into the reps experience?
Well, as a Milwaukee native, I'm just glad to have made the rather circuitous route back home, as it were, and have Milwaukee audiences see something written by one of their own. I am most excited to see and most interested to see what references in the show Milwaukee audiences specifically are going to get, because being an indoor county, you get a lot of people who are pretty close to Green Bay or live in Green Bay and make the commute up, who would get a lot of very specific references. There's some restaurants mentioned that are Green Bay specific restaurants, and I'd just be very curious to see what Milwaukee audiences respond to, if they respond in the same way that they did at Northern Sky's production. But for the most part, I think we've really done the best we can to craft a story that sort of transcends specific regional boundaries. I'm just happy to have this show be seen here in Milwaukee.
So if the Packers team motto is Go Pack Go, what's the motto for your play?
Well, I actually wrote a song in the show that I didn't really intend for it to be a motto, but it really does kind of sum up the whole purpose of it. And the song is called "When the Packers Play, Put Your Troubles Away." It's a rule in the house of the family of the show, the Kaczynski house, where no matter what else is going on, we are going to watch this game together as a family. We're going to root for the Packers as a family. And even if it's for just this 3 hours for this week, we are going to be a family unit come heck or high water.
All right. Well, Matt Zembrowski and John Daly, I want to thank you both so much for taking some time to talk to me about Dad season tickets. I enjoyed our conversation.
Oh, so did I. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Matt Zembrowski wrote the book, music, and lyrics for Dad's season tickets. Milwaukee actor John Daly plays the character Frank, and they both joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. Dad's season tickets opens this Friday and runs through January 2nd at the Milwaukee Rep. You can find tickets and more information at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for being here with us. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about the origins of Dia de los Muertos and how it's being celebrated in Milwaukee. Plus, we'll share the history of owls in folklore and how they came to be so closely associated with Halloween. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.